Oil drops to its lowest price in over a decade. What will it take down with it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, the 15th of January, and we're happy to be here with you. And Friday must mean it is time for the weekly wrap-up of the big economic topics in the news this week. I've got Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal and Catherine Rempel from The Washington Post, and we have got a lot to talk about. Hi, guys.
Hey, Molly.
Hey, Molly.
So, okay, oil. It closed today below $30 a barrel. That's the lowest in 12 years. We've talked a lot about the reasons why, but at what point are we going to start to see direct impacts, Catherine, on the rest of the economy?
I think we already have to some extent. I mean, it hasn't been good for capital investment. There was an article in the FT today or yesterday, I think, looking at the fact that a bunch of energy loans might be going bad, which could be hurting banks and could potentially have contagion effects for other portfolios. So, you know, it's been relatively good for consumers, but there are other ways in which it's not so great for the rest of the economy.
Yeah, Sudeep, what about less obvious impacts like we saw the abrupt closure of Al Jazeera America, which was blamed partly on oil prices because the Qatari government funded that journalism organization?
You're going to see all sorts of things like that in the U.S. and around the world. In addition to banks and plenty of investors will be very sad, there are companies that sprouted up in North Dakota and Texas and Oklahoma for the shale boom. They have to unwind. But the biggest issue is really going to be around the world. There's a huge number of countries that are unstable with cheap oil. Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Russia, all of those countries are very nervous right now with oil under $30. And they are If oil doesn't turn around, they're going to face some very, very serious problems in the coming months.
Well, and of course, it's dragging down the broader market. I know that if Kai were here, he would say that the market is not the economy. But Catherine, with these ongoing drops, what do you think? Is it going to start becoming an economy story?
I am skeptical about that, I would say, just because on other data points, we've done pretty well. Jobs growth looks really strong. We're finally starting to see some pickup in wages. Consumers are content. I wouldn't say they're ecstatic, but they're looking pretty happy. It's not translating to, stronger retail sales for some reason. But it just seems like, you know, to the extent that the concerns about oil are driven by China and other concerns are driven by China, the U.S. has relatively little exposure to China. So I think the U.S. is on a relatively strong footing right now, especially compared to the rest of the world.
So you think just a normal correction happening right now?
I mean, if you could even call it a correction, it may just be a temporary freak out driven by China, to be honest.
Sudeep, what do you think? Correction, freak out,
well,
ongoing?
It's clearly a correction, but we have to put it in much, much larger perspective. The stock market is now down 12% from the all-time high. That's just 12% after a run-up of almost 180% from those lows that we saw during the financial crisis. So this is what stock markets used to do once upon a time before the Federal Reserve was stepping in and was the only game in town. So this should be considered normal for the market to get scared a little bit. But that's what keeps investors honest, to let them realize that there's some risk on the other side of these bets, whether the bets are about oil or about a certain piece of the economy taking off. And so there is some concern here about the global economy. It hasn't been healthy for several years now. The U.S. economy has failed to really lift off in the way we've long expected, but it's certainly not falling apart. You just look at the job numbers and you have to say that we're staying relatively afloat pretty well compared to the rest of the
world.
Yeah,
I would argue that right. We're doing better than pretty much every other major economy on Earth. We've been pretty resilient.
All right. So then, Catherine, 20-second prediction. What do you think this means for what the Fed could do next?
I think they're going to hold tight and not raise rates anytime soon. They had said that even before we saw this volatility in the stock market. Janet Yellen said that it was going to be a very slow, gradual liftoff. So given the turmoil of the last week, it seems there's no reason to expect anything different.
All right. That's Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal, Catherine Rempel from The Washington Post. Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks, Molly.
Thanks, Molly.
And on Wall Street today, you probably heard a little bit about what's happening there, but we will have the bloody details when we do the numbers. Okay, now imagine the gas in your car being artificially cheap. I mean, even cheaper than it is now. The company that drilled the oil underpaid for permission to drill, and the pollution that driving causes is not reflected in the price. Now, instead of gas, substitute in the word coal. Today, the federal government said it will go back to the drawing board and try to fix the way coal companies pay to dig and mine on public land. Will that raise the price of coal? For sure. Is the coal industry already in trouble? Check. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
You and I, the joint American owners of federal land, may not be getting a fair shake when leasing it out to coal mining companies. That's talking point number one for Interior Secretary Sally Jewell. She spoke by conference call this morning on managing federal resources.
That includes ensuring the federal coal program delivers a fair return to American taxpayers and takes into account one of the most pressing issues of our time, climate change.
Jewell announced a halt to all new lease sales as her department revamps the system. 42% of American coal comes from federal land, but government auditors have been bashing the leasing program. They found the Fed sold leases at below market value, and in a key coal basin, 80% of sales went to one bidder. Did industry run the show? Mark Squillaci teaches at the University of Colorado Law School.
A system that was designed to be proactive on the part of the federal government, sort of setting the terms for how leasing was going to take place, became entirely reactive to what the coal industry wanted.
Today, the industry is on its knees. Cheap natural gas has undercut it, clean air rules make it pricier, and global demand is shot. So coal analyst Christopher Inton at Morningstar says a halt to new leases for more coal means little. The market doesn't want it.
The industry is just making too much coal for what this new normal is. What we expect is this industry to sort of right-size itself so that the production fits what demand is most likely to be.
Down the road, he says new lease prices that reflect carbon pollution will make coal even less competitive. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Sometimes, and this news might surprise you, sometimes politicians' economic proposals don't quite line up with economic reality. For example, in last night's GOP debate, Republican candidate Donald Trump repeated an idea he's mentioned a lot: throw tariffs on goods from China. He's previously pitched tariffs on Mexican products as well. Now, there's some dispute about the amount of the tariff that he would impose, but either way, he maintained the tariffs were a good idea.
So you're open to a tariff?
I'm totally open to a tariff. If they don't treat us fairly, hey, their whole trade thing is tariff. You can't deal in China without tariff. They do it to us, we don't do it. It's not fair trade.
So, okay, but what is it? For those of you who are wondering, here's Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson with a little tariff explainer.
It sounds so temptingly easy. Just throw a tax on foreign goods, make them more expensive, and give your local industry a boost. Except that's not how tariffs really work, says Susan Aronson. She's a professor at George Washington University.
He's trying to sell potential voters a lot of snake oil.
Aronson says higher tariffs are often passed on to consumers, as some Republican candidates pointed out to Trump last night. And this kind of protectionism doesn't help in the long run.
Putting tariffs on a Chinese product does nothing to train workers in how to be more productive, how to use new technologies to produce goods that people want around the world.
So since the 1930s, the U.S. has been moving in the opposite direction, going out to other countries and saying, hey, you lower your tariffs, we'll lower ours. The average U.S. tariff is now around 3.5%. Judith Goldstein is a poli-sci professor at Stanford.
Tracy, there's so many reasons it's not the right thing to do. I don't know where to begin. So almost immediately, there would be retaliation, legal retaliation.
China could go to the World Trade Organization and say these tariffs are unfair and ask for compensation. But these are economic arguments. And Goldstein knows they're a tough sell to workers who are losing to global competitors.
If you're, say, a steel worker and you're 55 years old, where are you supposed to go? Government, you know, they might give you some money to retrain. There's a little trade adjustment assistance, but not enough. You are going to do everything you can not to have to go through that kind of pain.
Tariffs, despite all economic evidence to the contrary, still have emotional appeal. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
For businesses in remote eastern Oregon, the armed occupation of a federal wildlife refuge outside the city of Burns is an economic windfall. A few dozen people started occupying the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge right after the start of the year. And they haven't left yet. So Burns hotels and restaurants are packed with reporters, law enforcement officers, and occupiers as a result. The Northwest News Network's Anna King has the story.
Just off a remote, slushy highway, the America's Best Value Inn has a horseshoe parking lot designed for truckers. Manager Vicki Allen says she's never seen a winter like this in Burns. 38 rooms, nearly full every night.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes we might only have one person in the house in the winter months. So this is, it's a godsend. It's like having summer all winter long.
But she admits it's sometimes a strange mix at the Continental Breakfast Bar each morning. Law enforcement and occupiers hovering over the coffee urn and Danish.
The police don't bother anybody. The militia don't bother anybody. We only get maybe two or three militia in here a week. They come to clean up and go back out.
Everyone has been well behaved, she says.
They just don't talk over the differences between them, you know.
For seasonal workers, too, this is a boon. In the winter here, some local businesses just shutter for months until spring.
I haven't had a day off since New Year's Day. And normally I have 4 days off.
Liz Hauer, a maid, says she usually doesn't have enough work this time of year to keep on.
It's good for me right now. because usually I'm on unemployment about this time.
Of the half dozen hotels I visited in Burns, most are selling triple or double the rooms they usually would this time of year. In town, the Bella Java and Bistro coffee shop is waking up. You have to clamber over piles of slick packed snow to make it inside. Regulars, like a table full of ball cap wearing Burns veterans, trek in for coffee. Strangers, too, like a posse of Oregonian newspaper writers. Manager Tammy Delane is working overtime in the back. Today she was making lunchtime beef wraps for the 10 or so law enforcement officers protecting the town's elementary school.
I wish it was different circumstances, but we do love it. It's helping the businesses as far as restaurants and stuff.
She says she's had occupiers in too. They've been polite, but the sheer volume of business hasn't let up.
Oh my gosh. It starts at 7:30 and coffees, breakfast, trying to do prep. Like I say, we're catering right now. Lunches are overwhelming, and they're still here at 3.
But not every business is getting a boost. Traffic at the B&B Sporting Goods store has been just a tick over average. The store's owner, Denny Thomas, sells about any make of gun, ammo, or knife, or he'll order it in for you.
We have high-end shotguns back there, higher-end shotguns, and rifles. These are our semi-automatic handguns.
At any time of year, he sells about 4 guns a day. Last week, he says that skipped up to 5 a day. But he says no occupiers are coming in for bulk buys.
We still have predominantly local shoppers. We get a few people coming in because they might need a pair of gloves. But other than that, things are pretty normal.
The hot seller this week, shotgun shells to ranchers. There's a rabbit population boom this winter. People are blasting them to keep the hungry bunnies off their haystacks. In Burns, Oregon, I'm Anna King from Marketplace.
Coming up,
the market for children's television right now is changing in quite dramatic fashion.
Oh, so that's why getting to Sesame Street takes an HBO password now. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 390 points, 2.3% to close at 15,988. The NASDAQ declined 126, 2.7% to finish at 4,488. And the S&P 500 dipped 41 points, that's 2.1% to end at 1880. We told you about the government's decision to halt new coal leasing licenses on federal land. Peabody Energy shed 6.6%. Other coal producers also lost ground. Cloud Peak Energy was off nearly 7%. Consol Energy fell 11%. Walmart announced it will close more than 150 stores in the United States. The stock slid 1.7%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.03%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
You're listening to Marketplace. I am Molly Wood. There is a small but growing move afoot to require universities with multi-billion dollar endowments to stop charging tuition. In fact, some proponents of the idea are trying to get a seat on the board that oversees Harvard, and a New York congressman is sponsoring legislation to require rich universities to spend more of their endowments on tuition assistance. It sounds like a pretty simple argument, right? Tap the endowment to cut the cost of school. But there's more to it than that. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
University endowments aren't big liquid pools of money like what every parent with a kid in college wishes for.
They're not rainy day funds or simple checking accounts that colleges and universities have to call on.
That's Liz Clark with the National Association of College and University Business Officers. Clark also says schools can't always spend their endowment money any way they want.
There are spending restrictions, and those restrictions come from donors' wishes to institutions.
So a donor might say, hey, here's $300 million, but it's for the medical school. And Clark says an endowment is a collection of different donations. In Harvard's case, thousands.
Harvard's endowment is actually made up of more than 12,000 individual funds.
That's Harvard spokesman Jeff Neal. He says there are other limits.
Endowments exist to live in perpetuity,
meaning they outlive their donors. So Neal says universities largely leave the original donation alone and just spend whatever they make investing it. Some people say at the richest schools, that return on investment would more than pay for free tuition. Victor Fleischer teaches law at the University of San Diego.
A lot of these endowments have had very impressive returns. There's still some additional flexibility there in terms of the spending of the funds.
But tuition assistance may be growing regardless. Liz Clark of the Business Officers Association says more donors are earmarking their gifts for student aid. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We've got a list of the biggest college endowments and the tuition that they charge on our website. That's marketplace.org. And food companies are having all sorts of trouble with their brands lately. Many are struggling to defend how healthy their products are or whether they have GMO ingredients. But another big issue that could really hurt their brand is food fraud. That's where suppliers may do things like substitute products or ingredients with lower quality, cheaper ones. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that story.
A lot of food ingredients can be adulterated, according to food fraud investigator Mitchell Weinberg.
Spices, almost every kind of consumable oil, fruit juice concentrates, flavorings, I mean, you name it.
Weinberg says fraudsters usually just want to make money by cutting corners, but a few incidents have caused major harm. Nearly a decade ago, infant formula and pet foods were contaminated with melamine. It's an industrial chemical. Thousands of infants in China were sickened. Some died, as did scores of pets in the U.S. John Spink of Michigan State University says the cases heightened food fraud awareness.
We really realized this could be global, and it could be big, and it could have a huge public health threat.
A Food and Drug Administration rule is requiring companies to have written food safety plans to address these kinds of threats. And the threats are costly. Reputations and bottom lines suffer from product recalls.
Food fraud is a huge multi-billion dollar problem.
Amy Kircher directs the Food Protection and Defense Institute at the University of Minnesota. The institute helps identify red flags for food fraud.
The longer a supply chain is, or the more complex a product is, there's more vulnerable points.
The firm PwC has also developed risk assessment tools. PwC's Sally Bernstein says as the world population grows, so does demand for food products.
Combine this with our continuing climate impact and different perspectives about using GMO,
some of these resources we have are going to get scarce, costs are going to go up.
And she says when that happens, there's more potential for fraud. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Sesame Street launches its 46th season tomorrow with a revamped theme song, a freshened up street, and a new home, HBO, where it will be available to subscribers only for the first 9 months before it moves over to PBS. Setting aside the question of whether there will now be lots more swearing on Sesame Street, the move is just one example of the changing landscape for children's television. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has our story.
All right, cue the cuteness.
What's your favorite show?
That
was Space Racers, Maya the Bee, Blaze, Paw Patrol, and Chuggington. Preschoolers and kids in general have dozens and dozens of shows to pick from these days. A far cry from the Saturday mornings of my childhood, when it was pretty much long cartoon blocks on the networks and a whole lot of ads.
The market for children's television right now is changing in quite dramatic fashion.
Jim Steyer is the founder and CEO of Common Sense Media. It's a nonprofit that rates and reviews kids' programming. One change? Kids' TV has faded from the broadcast networks. They can make more money off adults and sports. And cable networks like Disney and Nickelodeon are having to defend their turf against streaming services and even YouTube.
We're seeing a new paradigm where parents and families have more choices, where you're seeing cord cutters and streaming systems that give more options to kids and families.
A 2014 study from SNL Kagan found nearly a quarter of the TV content on Amazon is for kids. Nearly a fifth of Netflix shows are geared to children. They've got the classics.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood.
And they're producing their own shows, like Tumbleleaf on Amazon.
Oh, hi. I'm Fig the Fox.
Steyer says there are good reasons subscription services are going after kids.
It's a big market, and you can make a lot of money. And you can also build lifelong loyalty among kids and families.
Because while it might be easy enough to cancel your Netflix subscription when House of Cards ends, it'll be a lot harder if your kid becomes a rabid fan of dino trucks. And that's not all. Tim Westcott is an analyst who covers the entertainment industry for IHS.
Kids will watch episodes of an animation series repeatedly. So you get a lot more mileage out of that kind of programming if you're targeting a kids' audience.
Westcott says parents may also be more willing to make the subscription deal because...
A subscription model means they're not bombarded with commercial messages and advertising as much.
But parents aren't willing to settle for what used to pass as children's programming, and that's driving up costs. Sesame Workshop, which makes Sesame Street, lost more than $7 million in fiscal year 2015. Part of the reason it struck a deal with HBO was to help keep the show on the air. Leslie Rotenberg is the general manager of children's media at PBS, which makes shows like Curious George and Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood.
Kids who are used to seeing, you know, just really, really high quality media, and that's what they expect all the time now.
Also, creating a show is much, much more involved.
We used to think about a show as being linear and narrative. Now we think of a show in terms of transmedia. We're creating a world that kids can play in.
On tablets, on computers, PBS Kids has more than 40 apps. But for all the changes in kids' television, Rotenberg says kids still want the same things they've always wanted. Fun characters who their parents will let into the living room, and good stories, which they're much better at describing than I am.
Because I like it. It's my dad's show.
I like when a plane through everything.
Because I love it so much. Closure bonks his eyes and then they wiggle.
And who doesn't like some good wiggling now and then? I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
I kind of hate to pile on Disney, what with its stock down almost 5% today. But ESPN continues to drag the company down. It's the reason one Barclays analyst just downgraded Disney, saying that ESPN's reliance on the Baroque pay TV bundle makes it extremely vulnerable to cord cutters. It's already lost 7 million subscribers in the last 2 years, but that is not all. It turns out that even if Disney finally relented and spun off ESPN into its own subscription service, priced at a hypothetical $20 a month, a new survey reported on Quartz today finds that 85% of people would not be willing to pay for it. Oh no, but there's even more. The survey by BTIG Research also asked people what they would do if they could save $8 a month by removing ESPN and ESPN2 from their cable bundles. It turned out that 56% of the 1,600 people who responded said they would happily ditch the sports channels. Looks like Disney's going to need a miracle play to save this game. And that is our show. Today, the Dow lost 390 points, 2.3%. Just try not to think about it. It's Friday. The NASDAQ declined 126 points, 2.7%. And the S&P 500 dipped 41 points, 2.1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. And I am Molly Wood. We'll be right back here again on Monday. Have a great weekend, everyone. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.